This is Rhode Island's longest running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Sowa. Market insights and so much more. Talk to Don now, 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Sowa on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And I'd like to welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. I am Don Sowa, delighted to have you here listening to the show. You know, on today's program, something very, very interesting. If you've been listening to Money Talk over the last 25 years that we've been broadcasting here in Southern New England, it wouldn't shock you to by the statement I'm about to make, and that is that you have heard on many occasions of a gentleman named Warren Buffett. Nowadays, when you're dealing with politics or the economy or the markets or anything else, you hear his name brought up on a great many occasions. I'm sure there are a great many brilliant people out there, economists, pundits, Wall Street analysts, and everyone else, who either feel the need to publicly agree with the Oracle of Omaha, as he's known, or they disagree with him. And they've even gone so far as to either praise him for his extraordinary skills or to lambaste him, suggesting he's just too old, he just doesn't get it anymore. Well, I had a great opportunity to look at a few articles on Mr. Buffett, and one of them in particular was in a magazine called The Business Insider. And that, in addition to some other pieces that I looked up independently, I was able to come up with about 22 facts about Warren Buffett and who he is and his wealth and his reasons for and views of and strategies behind his wealth and success. And I came up with about 22 facts about him that you might find very, very surprising. So since some of those facts are, in fact, teaching lessons, and I'll try to list the fact, give you some background, and then maybe do a little bit of change, a little bit of evolution to try to say, well, how does that affect that fact affect you and me? Make it useful, make it part of a get-back-to-basics educational format. That's what we'll do during the course of the show today. I think this may be both interesting and a little bit fun. Some of the things you're going to hear about Mr. Buffett will surprise you, because they certainly surprised me. And who knows, maybe we'll learn something. They call him the Oracle of Omaha because he's come up with a lot of interesting ideas that have helped a great many people make an awful lot of money. And we would like, certainly, you being a listener here to the Money Talk program, we'd like you to join that list of people who've been able to make money from the wisdom of people like Warren Buffett. And we have a number of other mentors that I've followed over the years. And certainly here on Money Talk, we'd like to share those thoughts, ideas, and some of that wisdom with you. A couple of things about Buffett I think you'll find fascinating. First of all, when he was in elementary school, back when classmates were dreaming about maybe playing baseball or football or maybe becoming an actor in Hollywood or something, a 10-year-old Warren Buffett was having lunch with a member of the New York Stock Exchange, and at 10 years old was already setting some of his life's goals. His legendary career all began at that time, he sort of had an epiphany at age 10. He was on a trip with his father to New York City, dining in New York with a member of the New York Stock Exchange. It planted the idea in this young Warren's head that he was going to organize his entire life around money and the world of money. Interestingly, he bought his first investment, his first stock holding, at the age of 11. He purchased multiple shares of Citi's Service Preferred at $38 a share. Some of you probably have never even heard of that, but of course he's looking, doing his research and looking at things that are important to him. Now, by the way, this program and anything we're saying to you here on Money Talk, whether it's something that I suggest from personal thoughts or observations or something that we are quoting from these various articles that we've read about Warren Buffett, none of this should be interpreted or thought about as recommendations to you as to something you should go out and do right away. Many, many things that worked in the time frame that they did work for Warren Buffett may or may not work today here in the 21st century. But there's some great philosophy that can be learned by studying the behavior of some of the great investors of our time. So this Money Talk program is about basics. It's not about specific recommendations. It is about learning, though, from history and learning from people who have been successful during the course of history. When Buffett was a teenager, he was already raking in about $175 a month, more than his teachers at school, probably more than most adults. Now, he, interestingly enough, actually pulled this off by doing something that you might have done as a teenager, and it's something that I actually did with my brother Johnny when we were young, and that was we delivered newspapers. He delivered the Washington Post dutifully every week, probably given the amount of money they suggest he was earning each month, he was probably delivering an awful lot of newspapers. But hey, listen, part of what we need to learn and part of what a new generation of young people coming out of school need to learn today, given some of the opinions we're hearing out on the political trail, is they've got to learn that there is, in fact, no success without major, thoughtful, prudent investment of your effort, investment of your time, maybe even more so, and certainly of your energy, even more so than your money. So hard work is going to be at the centerpiece of the success of most people that you hear about today in the 21st century who've acquired great wealth or enjoyed their version, whichever that is, of great success in their lives. Now, he had amassed, and you got to keep this in mind, Warren Buffett is not a kid, is he? You know who I'm talking about. You can envision him in your mind. Gentleman's in his 80s. He had amassed the equivalent of $53,000 by the time he was 16 years old. Folks, that's a lot of money. Paper delivery was just one of many small businesses a young teenage Warren Buffett orchestrated. He sold used golf balls. You know, the ones you pull out of the grass, out of the bushes, and maybe even out of some of the ponds at the local places, driving ranges and golf courses at night. He washed, waxed, and buffed automobiles back in the day when probably most of them were black. And you know, let's face it, a black automobile, no matter how fancy the auto is, it just doesn't look all that good unless it's black, unless it's shiny and clean. He actually set up a pinball machine business as a teenager. And he actually turned a horse track into a lucrative playground. Go figure. Interesting guy. Interesting ideas. What you're getting out of some of this discussion when you look at some of his businesses, you learn, number one, he was innovative, he was thoughtful, and he was creative. And he believed in his vision. He had a vision. He had a dream. And he followed that dream. And he was willing to put whatever effort into that dream as was necessary. A big deal. Interesting, here's a big thing that I found shocking, and I found a lot of these elements quite surprising. I thought that you would too, if I did. He was actually rejected upon his application to Harvard Business School. Imagine how Harvard must have felt later on. Buffett, confident that he actually nailed his admissions interview pretty solidly, had already told a friend, "Join me at Harvard," he said. Part of his problem is he said he looked about 16 years old, and he was probably emotionally, you know, he thought maybe he was even younger than that emotionally. He recalled of the in-person interview, forced to look elsewhere, he settled on Columbia University rather than Harvard. Not too bad, though, huh? Which only required a written application. There was no in-person interview. So he was one of those folks that no matter how brilliant or hardworking he was, probably simply didn't interview well. Are any of you like that? So what the idea behind that, I guess the message is, don't let yourself get overly discouraged simply because you didn't make it the first time or the first option you thought was appropriate for you simply did not work out. Warren Buffett found an option that certainly did work out for him. I'm Don Sowa, folks. You're listening to the Money Talk program. Thanks for tuning in. I'm going to take a quick break right now. We'll be back with more Money Talk. We're talking about Warren Buffett, but not a long-term history of the man. Some of the surprising and interesting things about him that nobody ever heard of or typically don't talk about. This is Money Talk. I'll be right back. And we're back with the Money Talk program, everybody. It is Get Back to Basics today. And I figured one of the basic ways to help with the process of education, we all need to be constantly educating ourselves, expanding our horizons, and probably learning lessons from the successful folks in the past Let them be the basis upon which our future success is really focused on. Warren Buffett. Now, we could just sit there and read off a biography for you. I mean, the guy has done an awful lot of things over an awfully long period of time. But we're focusing on today's program on things that not only has he done, but there are elements and there's lessons in all of them. But they are those things that would truly surprise you. Probably things you'd say, geez, I didn't know that. Or that's not something I would have expected. Warren Buffett's idol as a young man, and of course he idolized him from readings, because as a teenager even and into his early 20s, he certainly wanted to be an investor. He wanted to learn a lot about the markets. He started investing while he was in his teens. So he read the books of a gentleman named Benjamin Graham. And again, Ben Graham is one of those people whose books on a number of different topics are the basis of a great many very, very successful investment professionals that have come in the years that followed. He was the author of an early book early on. One of Buffett's favorite books is called The Intelligent Investor. So originally, Buffett said, hey, it's not enough just to read the books from this gentleman. This guy's successful. I want to learn at his shoulder. I want to, you know, be tied at the hip to him as best I can. He idolized him. So, needless to say, Graham rejected him when he applied for his job. He applied for a job with Benjamin Graham, and he was rejected. Now, again, you have to understand back in this era, whether it's on Wall Street or in big, big, great markets all over the world, whether it's London, Paris, you know, Miami, L.A., Chicago, or New York City, there were a great many major businesses, major successes that were built upon ethnic tradition. Benjamin Graham was a very prominent Jewish financial professional in New York City, and he felt most comfortable, I guess, which is probably the reason he had this as a little rule in his mind, hiring people of Jewish faith and Jewish cultural tradition. And Warren Buffett was not Jewish, so he didn't get the job. I've heard numerous stories about major firms, extremely well-known investment firms in New York City. And if you just look at the names on the firms, you'll realize that a great many of them were, in fact, started by extremely brilliant, very prominent Jewish professionals, especially in the investment world. Banking was the same way. That happened, truthfully, in Europe very dramatically, and it was also the case here in the United States. Buffett wouldn't take no for an answer, however. That was part of his unique personality, and he continued pitching Benjamin Graham, not only just continually trying to ask him jobs, but sending him what we might call a white paper today, sending him papers with ideas. Lots of different ideas related to investing, information on research that he had done on a number of professional potential investments. Sooner or later, I guess Buffett just wore Ben Graham down, and he was so impressed, and despite the fact that he wasn't Jewish, Warren Buffett got a job with Ben Graham, and that was a big, big deal. The level of influence that a gentleman like Graham had, the type of a resume that you would have as a young financial professional, saying that you work for Ben Graham was a big deal and would open a great many doors for a young professional like Warren Buffett. Now, just to show you personality traits, everybody thinks of Buffett. I mean, you see him, you've probably seen him or heard him in numerous interviews on television. Certainly a number of print interviews. How many interviews have been published about him or with him over the years? You can't even find a count for it. But he spent about $100 of his pocket money at one time to take a public speaking course with Dale Carnegie. He was 21. He knew that there would possibly be and very likely be a need for public speaking in his as a professional. And he was terrified of it. So it ended up being a worthy investment for him. Because interestingly enough, and I thought this was fascinating, I thought that he was being driven by professional reasons. But the fact is he was so nervous, he ended up using the nature and the elements that he learned in the public speaking course to propose to his wife. So, hey, listen, couldn't possibly find a better reason to spend $100 early on as a young man. Now, you look at people of extraordinary success, of extraordinary wealth, and you try to say, well, how does this success affect their character, who they really are? Well, the house that Warren Buffett owns to this day is in Omaha, Nebraska. So he's a Midwestern guy, always continues to be a Midwestern guy. He had basically a fairly humble five-bedroom house. Back in 1956, he purchased it for his young family, and he paid $31,500 for it. That is still the house that he lives in today in Omaha, Nebraska. I don't know that he hasn't done some renovations inside. Maybe there's some new modern appliances in the kitchen, possibly. Maybe they, you know, put a polished granite countertop in the bathroom. I don't know. But a gentleman like Buffett, he is at the nature. If you listen to him talk, even if you happen to be listening to him talk and doing an interview with Becky Quick from CNBC, and he's on board a Gulfstream private jet, you still get this sense from him, if you just closed your eyes, that he was sitting, you know, in an old rocking chair on the back porch of his house in Omaha, you know, spewing wisdom. And it's probably wisdom worth listening to. But the house in Nebraska, $31,000 in 1956, he still lives there. If you want to be a Buffett neighbor, the house across the street from him was recently purchased. I think, I don't know whether it was, I believe it was actually purchased, but it would cost you $2.15 million today. But you know, even that, a $2 million house for a gentleman like Warren Buffett, you might say, hey, not exactly slumming, but it's an indication that he doesn't have to be living in a 30-room house on the top of the mountain overlooking the Hollywood Hills, or he's not out in the Hamptons somewhere with a $50 million home overlooking the bay. He doesn't actually keep a computer on his desk. How's that? It's the technology. He's a bit of a technophobe, he said. And he doesn't have a smartphone. He's, to this day, he continues to carry a flip phone. He said the first time he saw those things on Star Trek, you know, you flip it, beam me up, Scotty. He just thought that was very, very cool. And then all of a sudden, Motorola came out with, I guess it was called the StarTAC phone. Wonder if it was a play on Star Trek. Well, either way, he just thought it was such a cool idea. And ultimately, in the end, what does it do? It makes phone calls. And you can put it in your pocket or clip it to your belt. He says, well, that's about as efficient as I need it to be. Another thing, too, is, like I said, there's no computer on his desk. When he likes to look up information, how many of you take the time, even now, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, to either go to your laptop, your Droid, or whatever it is, your smartphone, and Google the word or the phrase you're looking for or the name of the person? What does Warren Buffett do when he wants to look something up? He has got the World Book Encyclopedia on the shelf in his office next to his desk. That's pretty amazing. And he doesn't, you know, I was looking at a picture, because I'm reading, you know, I was reading this article about him, from which I get a lot of this information, from the Business Insider. A gentleman's name was James Altucher. And some of this information also came from CNN, just so you all, you know, we're going to give credit where credit's due for all this cool information about Warren Buffett. But they showed a picture of his office over there in Omaha. And it's like a basic desk that the principal at your high school might have when you're called in. It's got a matching credenza behind the desk. But I'd say that the desk and the woodwork in the office and the credenza and the shelving next to him and all, stuff probably looks at least 30 years old, maybe more. Maybe an old-style English oak. And then there's a leather chair, not a particularly fancy one, not a big, you know, not even an ultra-high back leather chair that probably swivels a little bit. But that's what he sits on, you know. And of course, the credenza behind him does not have the fancy computer we just mentioned. Instead, it's got, well, probably the pictures of all of his children, grandchildren, and other people that he cares about. You know, there's something, it's like sitting, going into the office that you'd imagine your grandfather, if he was a businessman, might have in his home. And a lot of people think of him sort of as the grandfather of money and finance. You know, before we go to break, one more little piece of information about him. He has only sent, in his lifetime, one email. He sent that to a guy named Jeff Rakes of Microsoft. Man, the guy doesn't have a smartphone, doesn't send emails, and doesn't have a laptop or a PC computer on his desk at his office. Interesting story for one of the wealthiest men in the entire world. I'm Don Sowa. You're listening to the Money Talk program. It's halftime here I'm going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back. So please stick around. We're talking about Warren Buffett and things about this man that would just blow your mind. We'll be right back. And we're back with the second half of today's Money Talk program. Delighted to have you with us. It's a get back to basics approach to who you are as a financial decision maker. Yeah, we're all financial decision makers, whether we're investing, whether we're dealing with credit and debt, whether we're trying to figure out how to pay our bills at home, or whether we are just trying to take a look at what the future can be and decide what kind of a financial person, a financial entity we want to be. And it doesn't hurt. It doesn't hurt from time to time to look at other people who've done this same thing, going through the same process and evolution, and the ones that have done it with great success. And I'm sure there's occasions when we will point out people who've made financial decisions that were failures. Sometimes we learn more from failures than we do from successes. Well, Warren Buffett is clearly a success story. We mentioned earlier in this program that he does not have much in the way of technology in his life. He doesn't have a computer on his desk, his office. He doesn't have a smartphone in his jacket or pocket or in his briefcase. He carries a flip phone in order to make actual phone calls. Now, I'm not sure what level of technology that is, whether he can do texting on there or not. But I had a flip phone myself when they first came out, but that was when flip phones were at the epicenter of technological advancement. I thought they were the coolest thing ever. But I said, what does he do with his time? I mean, he likes to look things up when he has a question in the World Book Encyclopedia that he has on the shelf in his office, as opposed to Googling it, as many of us would do ourselves. He loves to play bridge, and he probably plays bridge about 12 hours a week. And, of course, when you are one of the wealthiest men in the world, who do you like to play bridge with? Some of the other wealthiest people in the world. And one of his favorite bridge partners happens to be Bill Gates. Wouldn't surprise anybody, I suppose, from Microsoft. Now, you can't spend all of your free time, and I'm sure, I don't know how much real free time he has, but he does spend about 80% of his daytime, honestly, just reading. And he likes reading, of course, since he doesn't have an Amazon, device of some sort for reading, or reading on his computer screen or on his pad, iPad, whatever. He reads real books, real paper books. He loves paper books. When he just sits in his office and he likes to read all day. And I'm sure, and if anybody listens to him speak, even on a number of broad topics, you hear a great deal of wisdom that comes from the fact that he does manage to keep well read. Now, he does have some habits. For those of you who are looking for advice for your children, or even if you're in the car right now listening and some of your kids are in the car, you might not want them to realize that he has some very bad habits that are not necessarily considered healthy, even though he's lived a good long life. He drinks an alarming amount of Coca-Cola each day. This business magnate, as they call it, he's notoriously unhealthy eater. He said if he's eating 2,700 to 2,800 calories a day, probably a quarter of that, about 700 calories or more, is Coca-Cola. He says he drinks at least 5 12-ounce servings of Coca-Cola, and he does it every single day, on weekends too. He also likes to double fist, as he calls it, salt shakers. And don't put it past him to literally enjoy an entire bowl, maybe an entire pint of ice cream for breakfast on occasion. My brother Tom would love to hear that. He says, because he's one of those guys that even after a big meal in the evening, an hour and a half later or something, if he's sitting around watching TV, he needs that nighttime snack, typically ice cream and vanilla bean, if you're wondering what kind of ice cream to get for him, okay? Warren Buffett probably would look at my brother and say, hey, you're doing the right thing. That's okay by me. I've done it myself for a lifetime. Now, another interesting fact, now this probably is not a shocker, but it is interesting. About 99% of his wealth was earned after his 50th birthday. And everybody, wonders, well, they've been accumulating all of this money over an entire lifetime. I think a lot of the great habits, a lot of the great philosophies that he developed happened during his youth and in his adolescence. But again, it just shows you how time becomes such an extraordinarily powerful instrument and vehicle when building your wealth. even if you're only putting away small amounts of money, if you're doing it regularly and you do it over a long period of time and do it consistently, you will acquire substantial amounts of wealth, much more than would normally surprise you. Among investing legends, Buffett has the longest track record of beating the stock market. The longevity of Buffett's outperformance is greater than that of a great many other very, very savvy investors, such as Walter Schloss or David Einhorn, who are names you still hear today, who have made billions in the markets, including efforts related to hedge funds and other things, active investors. $1,000. Now, here's a story for you. The company Berkshire Hathaway is Warren Buffett's company. He bought it back in around, or he put it together, what became Berkshire Hathaway, was available publicly traded back in and around 1964. And if you had invested $1,000 in the Berkshire Hathaway stock back in 64, when Buffett took it over, he took over the company at that time, the shares at the time would have cost you $19 a share back in 1964. That 1,000 shares, if that's all you did, and you never chose to add any to it at all, but if you bought it back in 64, it would be worth $11.6 million today. That's $1,000. It's a lot of money, huh? Again, a story and a testament to consistent, stable investing over time. And probably the person who's looking at that million now, or maybe $100 million because they bought $10,000 worth, they're saying, well, the reason I am actually so wealthy is that through the ups and the downs and the ups and the downs, and believe me, there were a lot of ups and downs during that period. I mean, 1964 to 2014, which would be, how many years is that now? Well, 64 would be about 36 years at 46 years. I mean, about 50 years or so. A lot of people over a 50-year period. I mean, how many things have happened in the markets over a 50-year period? They've gone up and they've gone down and they've gone up and they've gone down. And Buffett would say to you, he says, well, the market has given you many, many excuses and reasons to not want to be an investor. Investors, owners, people who bought Berkshire Hathaway stock back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever, there were numerous times, he said, many, many, many times when he would have his investor meetings down in Omaha and all the owners, shareholders would gather there. He liked to keep it personal, like one big, very large family. And he sat back and said, well, you know, a lot of people had a lot of reasons, given the nature of the economy, the nature of the markets over a bunch of periods, a lot of times, a lot of negative rhetoric in the media. A lot of people would have had reasons to sell the stock. The ones who didn't became fabulously wealthy. Again, sometimes it is not just about time and money. It's about discipline and behavior. And Buffett has always said investor behavior was one of the biggest and most important elements of what he does. His personal net worth is greater than the gross domestic product or the GDP of the country Uruguay. Uruguay's 2014 GDP was about $57 billion. And Buffett is worth more than that. Now, again, that just kind of puts it in proper perspective, I guess. So far, probably in his lifetime, he has donated enough money to build four of what are called the Apple Spaceship campuses. The Apple campus was one of the last major projects of Steve Jobs, one of the ones he worked on, was a sort of futuristic-looking company campus, a campus that will feature curved glass panels, an underground parking garage, a private auditorium for keynote speaking and product launches, a 360-degree view of nature from within the building. And for whatever the cost of that might be, the campus, they said that the Apple campuses, they're about a $5 billion endeavor, and he could build four of those ultimately because Buffett has actually donated a lifetime total of about $20 billion. That's second as far as benevolence goes. That's second in terms of, you know, gifting to charitable organizations and education and nonprofits. Second only to who? His famous bridge partner, Bill Gates, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you know, has donated an awful lot of money all over the world for numerous different programs, and he, the foundation itself actually takes donations from other billionaires, including Warren Buffett, and takes those because the Gates Foundation is so efficient with the use of the money. One thing about being a benevolent individual, being like a Buffett or a great many others, is you have this ultra-concerted, you know how hard it was, you knew what you went through to raise that capital. And if you're going to now give it away to support the efforts of key charities, key nonprofits, medical research, education, you name it, if you're going to give it away after everything you went through to earn it, you want to make sure that every penny possible is going to the cause that you're trying to support. So for those of you who are ever thinking of making donations to major charities or organizations, the things you should be asking about in the charitable organizations should have this information on hand for you, is how many cents on the dollar go to fundraising and the administration of the nonprofit, and how many of it actually, how much of that money actually goes to the people that you're trying to help or to the cause you're trying to support. You know, there are organizations, and Buffett looks for these, and so does Bill Gates in terms of the way they spend money. They want to get it as close to 95 cents on the dollar going to the charitable effort as possible. And I believe they've probably been pretty successful. Folks, this is the Money Talk program. Let's get back to basics, talking about the guru, the great oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett. Some things about him that you probably didn't know or you might be surprised to hear about. Some of them might even blow your mind. We're talking about him here on Money Talk. I'll be right back. And we are back. This is the Money Talk program, talking about the Oracle of Omaha, Mr. Warren Buffett. Gentleman well into his 80s, one of the most successful people in the world of investing. Second wealthiest man in the world after Mr. Bill Gates, a good close personal friend and apparently bridge partner of his. Interesting to kind of keep wealth into perspective. Buffett, you know, you look at him in comparison to other people you may know about. According to Forbes magazine, Jennifer Lawrence, the actress, was the second highest paid actress in the year 2013. And she's estimated to have earned $34 million that year. Warren Buffett made $37 million a day in 2013. How's that? Now, there's a lot of things said about people like Buffett. I mean, he's made some political comments, and we'll even, if we have a chance, discuss at some point the concept of the Buffett rule, which is a tax policy. But he draws a salary from his company, Berkshire Hathaway. The salary is about $100,000 a year, and he tends to spend it kind of frugally. Now, the interesting thing is, we say spend it frugally. That's in the typical things that you'd spend within your own home or household. But, of course, a great many elements to what are his life, like flying around the world, if not the country, in private jets. And, you know, the types of places he would stay when he's visiting New York, when he's visiting major cities. I mean, when he's traveling on business, the company is going to be paying a great deal of that cost for him. So, obviously, a man doesn't fly into, you know, JFK Airport or, you know, London's Gatwick Airport or any other place for that matter in the world aboard a Gulfstream, you know, G650. The jets themselves cost $65 million to purchase. You can imagine what it costs to operate. And, you know, land pretty much wherever you like, because they don't need a gigantic airport. You can land in some of the smaller private airports, too, which is why these people like these private jets. But, I mean, you couldn't do that on a salary of $100,000. So when he was first quoted saying how he thinks it's unfair that the tax rate for his personal secretary is actually is higher than his own, a great many people embraced that. Certainly President Obama did as part of his tax policy and during his reelection campaign in 2012. But it was a little bit, even by his own discussion, a little bit disingenuous, because his tax rate was based on from an income perspective, was based upon the $100,000 salary. That's his earned income from the company. But when I said to you a moment ago that he earned $37 million a day, you know, that is growth in the value of his personal estate based upon the shares that he owns in Berkshire Hathaway. The value of those shares go up every year. The value of those shares increase some years rather dramatically, some years double digits. It's a multi-billion dollar corporation. And if a man is worth over $60 billion, the most of that wealth is in the value of his shares. So his he can have extraordinary years in which his wealth will build rather dramatically. And since he's holding these assets long-term, which for long-term capital gains tax purposes is well above a year, then his federal income tax or federal tax based upon long-term capital gains is not going to exceed 15% under the current tax code. You know, maybe 20% at a max depending upon state taxes included as well. So it's possible if his secretary's personal income, which she probably has a pretty good salary as Warren Buffett's secretary, but she could very easily be paying taxes at a rate of between 28 and possibly 31%. Now, that doesn't necessarily put her in the highest tax bracket of the country. Don't misunderstand when a person says, oh, well, what do you do for a living? I'm a secretary. No, you're Warren Buffett's secretary, and that's a big difference, and your salary will probably reflect that. And I can promise you she has also received stock options at Berkshire Hathaway. I can guarantee that, as would do with probably a great many other employees who've worked for Warren Buffett over the years. I'm sure he encouraged them to do so. Invest in the business you work for. It makes sense. The people, there are a great many multi-millionaires who were simply tellers, or you know, people working in the warehouses for Walmart when Sam Walton first created the company and went took some of those assets public, because many of them, especially in the early stages, were actually getting Walmart shares of the private company because they couldn't afford in the early days to pay really high salaries. So as those shares from Walmart became one of the best performing stocks in the market, guess what? They became millionaires over time. But Warren Buffett's vast wealth is going to be taxed in the form of long-term capital gains. His vast wealth comes from the appreciation of his corporately owned stock. People are so fascinated to meet and talk to the legendary Warren Buffett, they'll actually spend a lot of money just to have lunch with the guy. Buffett has been auctioning off what they call a power lunch since the year 2000. He does it at his charity event for Glide, G-L-I-D-E Foundation, the Glide Foundation. The highest bidder gets to bring up to seven people to dine with the steak-loving business magnate at Smith & Wolinski Steakhouse in Manhattan. And the most recent winner paid $2,345,000 for the privilege. Pretty impressive, I can imagine. You know, he doesn't think money equals success. He says he measures success by how many people love me. And the best way to be loved is to be lovable. I imagine he's much loved. He's a lovable guy. He's been good to an awful lot of people. And he's done well by a great many people who have trusted him. That's my story about Warren Buffett. Some of the surprises, the good, the bad, and probably no ugly at all. If we find any of that, we'll share it with you here on Money Talk as well. Have a good day.